You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Brookings and welcome to our forum on implementing the Affordable Care Act. My name's Elaine Kmark. I'm a senior fellow here and director of the brand new Center on Effective Public Management. So I'd like to welcome everyone here today for a very important discussion of a very timely topic. It's been a long time since the federal government had to implement a great big new program. 10 years ago, we saw implementation of Medicare Part D and implementation of the brand new Department of Homeland Security. In each instance, there were substantial growing pains, and there were predictions of disaster, as there have been with the Affordable Care Act. In the case of Medicare Part D, implementation exceeded expectations, and costs have not been nearly as high as was originally feared. In the case of the Department of Homeland Security, the implementation was bumpier. Nonetheless, 10 years later, both systems operate more or less smoothly, and in retrospect, the crisis looks overblown. This year, the Obama administration needs to finalize implementation of the Affordable Care Act, a historic piece of legislation and the most significant domestic policy achievement of the administration to date. And the question of how it goes is front and center. Even the president has admitted that there will be hiccups along the way. Compared to earlier pieces of healthcare legislation, this one is incredibly complex, involving activity in 50 states, 50 state insurance commissioners, and large changes in the private healthcare industry. And just to add to that complexity is a Republican Party that still doesn't like it, and in fact on Thursday voted for the 37th time to repeal the act. So the question that I'm going to pose to in the course of this conversation to my distinguished panelists is, how's it going to go? And to do that, I want you to be thinking, but don't answer it yet, I want you to be thinking of a continuum, all right? At one end of the continuum is the hiccup scenario. That means more or less normal, okay? It means that if the implementation is successful, the exchanges will be up and running. There'll be some glitches. Some people who qualify for subsidies won't get theirs and they'll have to appeal. Some people who don't qualify for subsidies will get theirs and somebody's going to have to run after them and try to get the money. There'll be those kinds of problems, but kind of within the normal startup. The second, the middle on this continuum, and I'm stealing this from David Brooks, which explains why he writes for the New York Times and I don't. He calls this shambolic messiness, which is just a great term, where there will be literally years of confusion, delays in opening many of the exchanges, serious problems with the federal hub being able to interface with the exchanges. There may be waivers to these rules while they're worked out, et cetera. There may be premium increases. There may be a whole lot of stuff. But in the end, the act will prevail. And finally, at the complete other end of the continuum is what I call the repeal scenario. And obviously, large numbers of people in this town and around the country, called Republicans, are rooting for this one. In fact, they seem to like this idea so much that they voted 37 times for it. So the question is, will this go, at the other end of the continuum, the route of the 1989 Medicare Catastrophic Care Act, which was passed, signed into law by President Reagan, and then repealed 16 months after its enactment, making it the shortest-lived piece of social policy in the history of the United States. Okay, so there's our continuum. But before we get to, and I'm going to ask you all to place yourselves on that, but don't do it yet, because before we get there, I want each of our panelists to discuss some of the implementation issues that they see. And I'm going to start with, I'll introduce everyone and then I'll call on them. I want to start with the distinguished Henry Aaron, right here, currently the Bruce and Virginia McLaurie Senior Fellow in Economic Studies here at Brookings. He has also been the director of the Economic Studies program. He came to Brookings in 1968. He also has taught at University of Maryland. In the 70s, he was the Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation at the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. He chaired the 1979 Advisory Council on Social Security. He is a member of the Institute of Medicine, visiting committee of the Harvard Medical School, and founding member, vice president, and chairman of the board of the National Academy of Social Insurance. He is the author of many publications dealing with Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, and I can't imagine a better person to have on this panel and to start us off. Sheila Burke, down there going alphabetically, and the only other woman on the panel, is an adjunct lecturer at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. I met her when she was executive dean of the school from 1996 to 2000. Before that, she has served as chief of staff to former Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole and as a professional staff member of the Senate Committee on Finance. Like Henry, she is a member of the Institute of Medicine and also the National Academy of Sciences and the American Academy of Nursing. She is also a nurse, just in case anybody feels a little ill as we start to discuss this problem. Or scared. Yeah. She's also been a distinguished visitor at the O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health Law, and she serves on the boards of the Kaiser Commission and the Future of Medicaid and the Uninsured. Right over here, in the middle, is Bruce Caswell. He is president and general manager of Maximus. Maximus Health Services brings more than 20 years of public sector health and human services program, policy, and operations experience to Maximus. He leads the company's global health operations, which provide administrative, program management, and operational support for programs including, and you'll see why he's here, the health insurance exchanges, Medicare, Medicaid, and the Children's Health Insurance Program, otherwise known as CHIP. This is the company's largest book of business, generating huge annual revenues, and they have a portfolio of contracts with Vermont, Connecticut, California, Minnesota, and Medicaid Administrative Services in 18 states and the District of Columbia. So they really are at the heart of the implementation game. And finally, he is at another very important meeting, so he's going to join us. So when he comes, you'll know who he is. We have Dr. Josh Sharfstein. He is the Secretary of Maryland Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. He previously served as Commissioner of Health in Baltimore, Maryland, and as Principal Deputy Commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. He has a long interest in health information technology, serves on the Health Information Technology Policy Committee for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And as you'll see, Maryland is one of the states that's actually made some real progress in this, so it'll be good to hear from the state perspective. So with that, what I'd like to do is ask our panelists a series of questions, and then, of course, we will open it up to all of you, as we always do. And I want to start with Henry, okay? I'd like you to start off this panel with a little bit of a historic perspective on the healthcare system. Nearly half a century ago, 48 years ago this summer to be precise, Congress passed legislation creating Medicare. And 10 years ago, they passed the Medicare Part D program, the prescription drug benefit. Recently, you said that nothing approaching the complexity of this rollout has ever happened in U.S. peacetime history. Can you spend some time telling us about this and about the problems, similarities, and differences you see in implementing ACA as opposed to these earlier bills?
I would be glad to do so. I want to add one item to what seemed like a complete roster of my life history that you gave at the outset. And that is that I currently sit on the D.C. Health Exchange and am vice chair, so I'm getting to see the implementation from the inside as well as from the outside. It does seem to me that there is one similarity between our previous experience with major health reform legislation and the current one. And I have to say that they all concern health care. Beyond that, I think the differences are more salient and important than the similarities. The first major difference, and it's critical, is that both the extension of Medicare to Part D and the original enactment of Medicare legislation were bipartisan efforts. The original Medicare program was a blend of Republican and Democratic proposals. Indeed, Wilbur Mills made it clear that he wasn't going ahead unless it was, and it ended up being that way. Similarly, with the extension of drug benefits, the addition of drug benefits to Medicare, there was substantial support on both sides of the aisle, although not all Democrats lined up with the president's proposal at the time. There's another difference which I think is of critical importance in understanding this bill, the Affordable Care Act, in contrast to Medicare, the original enactment. Medicare was designed with the administrators in the room as the legislation was being written. And that meant that the problems of implementation were considered as the legislation was being drafted. That was not at all the case this time. The administration backed off to a considerable degree. The legislation was largely drafted within Congress without very much Republican involvement, so it ended up being an internecine struggle among various Democratic legislative policy groups, but the degree to which administrative concerns were brought to bear in the design was, to put the matter gently, minimal. A third difference that I think is in a way paradoxical is that, in a way, both Medicare, the enactment of Medicare, and Part D were more radical programs than the Affordable Care Act, and I mean radical in the following sense. They created new programs that supplanted or replaced what had gone before. The Affordable Care Act bent itself in pretzels-like shape in order to accommodate to existing institutions and disturb current arrangements as little as possible. Given the fact that the U.S. healthcare system is exquisitely complicated, that meant that the legislation itself had to be exquisitely complicated, and it fully delivered on that characteristic. The final difference, and I think this is goes directly to the question, Elaine, that you posed to all of us concerning prospects down the road. We have, in my opinion, entirely for the worse, developed a very intense, fast-reacting, adversarial political environment in which analysis is done quickly, frequently sloppily, used in the manner of, what Alice Rivlin, sitting in the front row, once called forensic social science. That is, social science mobilized to make a legal or political case. And therefore, the elbow room that administrators have for working through problems before they are brought, sometimes almost hysterically, to the attention of the public, that elbow room has been decidedly narrowed. So let me stop with that difference. We can come back to the continuum you
we'll
asked
come
about
back
later.
To, yeah, come back to, we're going to come back to the continuum. As you noted, Dr. Sharfstein has joined us. Thank you very much. I'm going to give him a minute to catch his breath and call on Bruce. Bruce?
Great. Well, I think the perspective that we can bring is a little bit to your point at the administrative level and the operational level. So for certainly a company such as Maximus doesn't specifically get involved in the creation of the policy, but we're then the ones that look at that policy and figure out what are the business processes that need to be executed, what does the technology need to do to support the implementation of the act. So I've given some thought to the fact that there's a little confusion perhaps as to what day one might look like.
Yes, what does day one look like?
Take a few moments to talk about that. Certainly, it's important to understand that day one, and on day one, we'll be seeing Exchange version 1.0, and not to be confused with Exchange version 2.0, which will represent additional process improvements. There's no doubt that this is an incredibly complex undertaking, and it represents really the orchestration of many stakeholders, bringing together technology, importantly, consumer engagement, and all that that entails, revisions to the regulatory processes and the policies in the insurance market, all under very much a new program and policy environment that I think, as Dr. Aaron put quite well, has to be interwoven with existing program structures. So a very complex undertaking. Our perspective from the states that we're working with and others whom are working in the similar market is that the states and the federal government will make the October 1st deadline. Indeed, we'll have operational health insurance exchanges. But I think it's correct that the road will be bumpy for the initial period until things smooth out. And I thought I'd take a moment to talk a little bit about where we might see some bumps in the road and what's being done to address those. Above all, states and the federal government are very much focused on the consumer experience, on ensuring that consumer experience on day one is a high-quality experience, that individuals can seamlessly, ideally, traverse the programmatic boundaries between the various insurance affordability programs and Medicaid, for example. And as a consequence, when giving consideration to prioritizing functionality to be available on day one versus on day N, the prioritization is on back office manual workarounds and obviously things that won't disrupt that consumer experience. Many states are also in the process, it should be noted, of implementing new eligibility systems for Medicaid or what are sometimes called multi-program eligibility systems or integrated eligibility systems. And states are availing themselves of 90-10 federal money to do that, and they themselves are at various stages of progress in that implementation. And so just as we're looking at kind of exchange readiness in a number of dimensions, similarly, depending on where a state is in the implementation of the technology, that can signal the maturity of such things as system-to-systems interfaces. And from our experience, it's clear that states are thinking about the workarounds that they might need to implement until things such as those interfaces behind the scenes can be perfected, again, preserving the consumer experience. Another important element is that while we're talking about the individual exchanges largely, we're really talking about families more than individuals who will be applying for this insurance. And the family situations can be complex. You might have, depending on income thresholds and family composition, a father who qualifies for a subsidized policy, a mother who's newly pregnant who may qualify for Medicaid, a child who's on the CHIP program, maybe another child who's about to emancipate out of the CHIP program. So understanding those complexities has implications on the protocols and the handoffs that have to occur between the entities. So as we've thought about it, we've thought about kind of four things that states ought to be thinking about and focused on for day one to minimize the bumps in the road. The first I'd offer is the importance of the assisters and navigator programs out there. They are indeed the front lines of health reform to consumers. They need to be well-trained, certified, and importantly, coordinated in the messages that they provide, the policy, if you will, the procedures that they articulate, and well coordinated with the health insurance exchange service center staff and Medicaid staff. And it's worth noting there are actually four different categories of assisters. There are the navigators that we know about from the Act. There are in-person assisters, or IPAs. There are agents and brokers who, as many may know, can continue to be compensated by issuers but can't serve as navigators or IPAs. And there are certified application counselors. So the point being that individuals and families will be coming through multiple channels to receive this assistance from existing call centers. Some states have as many as a half dozen existing 800 numbers that consumers call for information. These new exchange customer service centers, the navigators and assisters I've mentioned, as well as local county and public health offices because of the no wrong door provisions of the Act. So coordinating and communicating is very, very critical there. Not every application also on day one is going to follow what we call, I guess a technical term in the industry, a happy path transaction. So the happy path is really what we envision with this goal of really click the card, where everything's done kind of seamlessly through a website clearly. That's a great goal, and that's something I think we continue to strive for as we move toward Exchange 2.0 and beyond. as well as things like mobile applications and so forth, mobile platform use. But in addition to those types of transactions, certainly there will be consumers that will be applying for exemption and exclusion from the individual mandate. They will want to ensure that the income that's being used for their eligibility is more current income than might be available through the Data Services Hub. And so having individuals that are well-trained in these customer contact centers to handle those types of transactions is critical. And ensuring, and this is something that we can learn from the Medicaid and CHIP world, creating special escalation units of more knowledgeable and fully trained individuals to handle those more complex cases can be an effective day one strategy. And then lastly, two other quick points. One is that regardless of whether a state is a state-based exchange, a federally facilitated exchange, or a state partnership exchange. And we can talk about those definitions shortly.
And I gave you, there's a handout that shows the map of which states have which.
Perfect, okay. Perfect. It's important to note that there are certain provisions of the Act that create requirements, ongoing requirements for those states and their operations, the no wrong door provision being a critical one. So ensuring that there's a choreography, if you will, between the local public health department offices and county-based offices where eligibility is currently determined, existing call center operations, the federal call center operations, and so forth, is critical. States have to make decisions still, for example, as to whether they are going to be a screen and refer state. So if they're in the federally facilitated exchange, will they simply get the information from the federal exchange and have it passed down and make final determinations at the state level, or will they have the federal exchange make that eligibility determination? Regardless of what they choose, however, they still own the responsibility for that case going forward and maintaining it. And then finally, the fourth thing that states, I think, are very much focused on is insurance market readiness, ensuring that qualified health plans are available for selection by consumers, that procurement processes effectively run its course, and that information can be uploaded, if you will, to the website to be presented in a good format for consumers to make a choice.
Okay, I think you're beginning to get a sense of how difficult this is. I just want to put a little personal anecdote in here. When I was a teenager, my father worked for the Social Security Administration, and his job was to write the training materials for Medicare. And he wanted to be very clear about how he was writing those materials. And so every night he brought them home, and he had me read the materials and answer the questions. So I do believe I was the only 15-year-old in America who knew how to determine Medicare eligibility. I don't know that I could have figured this one out. Dr. Sharfstein, Maryland is one of the all-star states. I mean, every press account says that Maryland is way up ahead of everyone else in planning for this, implementing it, et cetera. Could you tell us when you started, what you've accomplished, and then if you were to talk to a state, there's many of them, but let's say Idaho, that just in the last month decided that they'd start working on this, where would you have them begin, or what triage advice would you give a state that's just getting into this?
Sure. Well, thank you, and I apologize to everyone for coming a few minutes late.
That's okay.
Yeah, we talked about that. It was not a health reform-related problem that got me to be here. I think that we are very excited for October 1st and next year in Maryland. I think, we're doing everything we can. I'm not sure I can say whether we count as an all-star or not. I think our goal is to deliver. But from my perspective, Maryland has been had some unique advantages, and I'm particularly lucky because of the level of engagement that's existed in the state. And before I started as the state health secretary and the chair of the exchange board, there were some pretty important decisions made. The governor and lieutenant governor had a series of, I think, 20 or so public meetings around the state. They had hundreds of comments from the public. And they really had established a broad consensus that it made sense for Maryland to do a state-based exchange. And the logic behind that was that Maryland could control its own destiny, and that there are some unique aspects to Maryland's system that the exchange could be sensitive to, and be more likely to be sensitive to if it were a state-based exchange. And it was interesting to me when I started and I was on a few national panels, I would sit next to people who, you know, with some degree of understatement, were not huge fans of the Affordable Care Act from other states. And, you know, they would say how much they hated it. And I would say that, you know, we're supportive of the Affordable Care Act in Maryland, but there's an irony here, which is that I may be the only one on the panel who's supportive of the Affordable Care Act, but we're the only one going our own way. Everybody else is going to be stuck with the federal government's, you know, exchange in your area, when that was sort of like a term that they used with some amount of, you know, yeah, you pick your word. So you know, we were off on our own way. We see the Affordable Care Act in Maryland, and I think that the analogy that I use most commonly is a set of tools that states can use and customize in different ways to accomplish both improved access and control costs in different ways. It does not guarantee an outcome, but it provides some tools for states to use. And that's how we've really gone about it. So we've had actually three separate pieces of legislation pass and be signed by the governor so far. The first one was just to set up governance, and that proved to be largely to set up governance and identify the topics that should be studied in the state. And there were six studies that we did in the first year. The governance was absolutely critical.
What year was this?
This was 2011.
Okay.
And it was let's take it one step at a time. That's, you know, that's been our motto. And so we didn't rush out and say we're going to do it all this way and we've got it all figured out. We said, what's the governance? And the governance was 9 people on a board, 3 of them state officials, the health secretary and chair of the board, but we have 6 public members, really terrific people. The head of one of the retail associations in Maryland is on there. The former secretary is the executive director of the American Public Health Association, a ringer whose job it is to follow exchange development for Academy Health. He's a terrific person. Some health economists, a consumer advocate. So it was a great group of people. And then we set about studying these key issues, and we set up 4 advisory committees with about 20 Marylanders on each one. There was a stack this high of reports and comments, and people really felt like they were engaged, and we condensed it down to, I think, 28 or so recommendations for the legislature. And then in the 2012 session, the legislature passed a policy framework. And I have to tell you, when we started, I thought there would be like 12 issues that would cause all sorts of, you know, ugliness in terms of debate, but we actually really resolved them all. That legislation really sailed through. I give a lot of credit to the lieutenant governor, who brought everyone together in the legislative process, and we have a terrific head of the governor's office of health reform. So we had like we gave everyone a chance to submit amendments. We had like 300 amendments. We responded to each one individually. So if you were in Maryland, you submitted an amendment, you had an answer whether yours was getting included, and if not, why not? We did that for each of the 3 years, and then we set up the policy structure. We made some critical decisions that were unique to Maryland. We decided that we would try to integrate our small group exchange with the existing third-party administrators who sell most of the insurance to small businesses. We wanted to allow brokers to sell in the exchange without having to become navigators. There were a whole bunch of different things that really related to what we wanted to do in Maryland. And then the third year was for sort of fixing little things and getting the funding structure in place. So I think that it'd be unfair to say that we haven't had our share of disagreements, but we've had such an aggressively public and engaged process that we've been able, I think everybody's been willing to say, let's try to get this stood up as well as possible. And look, I've had to say to people on all sides of the issue that one of the challenges that hits me a lot is that people project onto the exchange either their fears or their hopes, and both of them can derail you. Like, if you say, like, the exchange is going to fix this long-standing problem we've always had in X service not being adequately reimbursed, it's like, I agree with you that's a long-standing problem, but maybe not by October 1st. You know, I mean, we've got to get this. Like, if we don't have an exchange that's functioning, it's going to be hard to fix that problem. And to the credit of people in Maryland on all types of different issues like that, people have really been willing to understand our mission is to try to be successful, you know, and stand something up and then decide how we're going to use it in different ways. And so there are a number of different issues, just to name a few, essential community providers and how the contracting will go, the brokers' commissions and how that, where we said we're not going to try to micromanage that. We will study it. We'll see how it goes. We're going to encourage certain things. We're going to encourage robust contracting. We're going to maybe even have some mixers for the plans to meet with the different people or, you know, but we're not going to try to dictate and get out doing that when we really need to be focused on the fundamental job at the beginning. So to your question about other states, I really do think that the governance structure is really important, and the ability to really engage the public and have people talk about what they want to get out of health reform, and think about it not as a uniform thing, but as a set of tools that can be applied. And then, you know, second, I think that you want to create a can-do spirit. And I think that I was incredibly lucky that with the board has really come together. We have had 2 years, tons of contested issues in terms of contested in the sense of when we went into it, I didn't know what the answer was going to be. You know, we had to talk it out. We've had one non-unanimous vote in open or closed session over 2 years. We probably had 100 plus votes. And it's because we kind of get to a point where people are really confident and there's a real kind of spirit of, okay, maybe I would rather it have this way, but this is a good interim step, and here's how we're going to collect information and kind of think about the next step. That one contested vote was, you know, on, not on what I would call a fundamental issue. I just said, okay, look, we got to move on. Let's just have a vote on this. And everybody laughed and voted, you know. So it's not like, you know, I think that that's been really important. So can-do spirit, focus on the governance, public engagement, and then be strategic. And I think, you know, deciding what you can and can't do in order to get going, it's obviously for people who are just getting started, that's going to be a more of an acute task. But you can do that by being really transparent about why. And we've said no, but it's more like no, but, you know, no, we're not going to do this now, but we're going to look into it. And I think that's got to be part of the kind of approach.
That's great. That's great. Sheila, I wanted to ask you something that's a little bit more about design than it is implementation, but of course it relates. The mandate to purchase health insurance is at the heart of the plan, and it is also the least popular item in the law. How do you think this is going to work? Will it get people who don't have insurance now to buy insurance? Is there a chance that the combination of the mandate and the requirement in the law for more robust plans, the qualified health plans, as they say in the law, will cause premiums to rise for those who qualify for subsidies and for those who don't? I mean, how is this all going? Do you see this all working together?
First of all, I have to thank you for inviting me. I have to say that when I first heard you addressing Josh, I thought you called him the AllSpark, which for any of you who are Transformer fans. That's a nice description.
Well, I guess that could be used too.
I think you have asked a series of questions, frankly, for which we don't know the answer. You're absolutely right that the mandate is, in fact, one of the most controversial aspects of the legislation. Certainly the Supreme Court decision and the debate that occurred around the mandate heightened people's awareness of that question. What its actual effect will be, how many people will actually affect, of course, are one of the questions that we don't yet know the answer to. Many of the issues that Henry raised, I think, are issues that, in fact, play out here in terms of the tension that exists in rolling the program forward and the tension between the feds and the states and the absence of a bipartisan agreement and the sort of red-blue dynamic that we're going to have to confront, which is going to be critical, frankly, in terms of what people know about the program, what they know about enrollment, and how that essentially plays out. If you actually think about the size and nature of the question, there are approximately 300 million people who we anticipate having coverage in this country in the near term. A large percentage of those individuals are already covered. They're either in employment-based coverage, they're in Medicare coverage, they're in Medicaid coverage, they're in TRICARE, they're in one of the many systems of insurance that exist in the country. There are a large number of people, frankly, who will be exempt. And the basis for their exemption could be on income, could be on their member of a tribal organization, could be on a host of qualifications that essentially exempt them from this mandate. The latest estimates by the Kaiser Family Foundation suggest that there are about 30 million people that we believe will be subject to the mandate, who essentially neither have incomes that are too low, or premiums that exceed essentially their capacity to finance them. So you're looking at a universe of about 30 million. Now, one of the critical questions in terms of the mandate, of course, is its importance to the success of the program going forward, and the risk, essentially, of the exchanges and the other programs that are formed, essentially not having an adequate number of people that are both healthy as well as unhealthy. And so one of the desires, of course, in the creation of the mandate was to essentially get people into the system so that you could essentially spread the risk and avoid some of the issues that have existed historically with essentially individual and small group coverage, which has been very costly because it tended to be, really draw people that were most at risk. Well, one of the questions, of course, and the risk going forward in the exchanges is whether, in fact, only those people who are most at risk and essentially need coverage essentially decide to require themselves to essentially purchase that coverage. I think one of the great conundrums is how do you get the young, healthy invincibles? And that's really the target of the mandate, to try and get the broadest possible population to enroll in these programs. I think of my own 25-year-old son, and whether or not, if faced with a penalty of $95 or a premium in excess of $4,000, what his decision might be. So some of the questions that Henry raises and that others have raised about what the coverage will be, what the cost will be, are, of course, questions we don't yet know the answer to. We know that, in fact, there are essential health benefits that must be covered. We are only now beginning to see what participation there will be on the part of insurers in the exchanges. They are only now essentially at the state level making that decision. We don't yet know what the product cost will be. Some of those conversations are beginning to occur. I'm sure Josh has already begun to see some of those conversations in Maryland. In states like Oregon and Washington, we're hearing that, in fact, the premium costs are not going to be as great as were expected. But in other states, there is, in fact, a fear, as Elaine suggested, that the size of the benefit that is now required as a result of the ACA will, in fact, be more costly than people have experienced in the past, even with, essentially, the protections that are provided in the law with respect to rates. You have, essentially, the requirement of guarantee issue, no pre-existing conditions, things of that nature that some believe will, in fact, increase the price of those products. So the question as to whether or not people will participate will be based on their knowledge. We also know that there are very few people who fundamentally really understand what it is that's required under the law and what the expectations will be for them. All the polling that suggests that there's a large percentage of people that don't yet know what's in the ACA. And so, again, this may come as a surprise to some. You will have people who will make the judgment that the cost of the penalty, which many believe to be too low, it is in fact less than was required in Massachusetts, is not sufficient to in fact encourage people to essentially get coverage that may be quite costly for them, particularly those who perhaps may not qualify for the subsidies. So you have knowledge, you have essentially cost, you have a product that you're not yet certain of in terms of what insurers are going to participate in each of the states. So that is yet to be discovered. So there are a great many of those things that we don't yet know. You have questions, again, in the blue-red environment into which states will, in fact, actively, aggressively seek out and try to, in fact, make people aware of what's available. We've heard a lot of discussion over the last few days and few weeks over the efforts to essentially publicize the benefits of the ACA, in fact, what the requirements might be. Those will play out differently in every state. And there will be some states like Maryland and others who will make an aggressive attempt to try and make people available. Certainly the websites, the navigators, a variety of sources of information will be quite important. But those will vary enormously by state, where there'll be some states that are quite well equipped to do that and essentially have put those systems in place, and other states who will be slow to essentially take up that mantle. And in those states, in fact, you may have a little take-up or resistance to take-up that occurs. So I think we really don't yet know. I think it will essentially play out over the next few months as those efforts take place over the summer, and also will depend largely on the states and the kind of information that the states make available. Ultimately, it will also depend on what the product looks like, what the price looks like, and whether or not people feel compelled to do so, or whether it again becomes a source of coverage largely for people who are at risk and very costly.
Great. I want to ask the panel, and anyone can answer this, a question that is actually prompted by news reports lately, okay, which is the IRS scandal has been now bleeding into healthcare as well over the issue of the federal hub. Now, the federal hub is the place where data from five different agencies comes together in order to tell the states whether or not someone in that state applying should get the federal subsidy. Now, it's a complex information technology question, but the issues now that are arising have to do with privacy issues, okay? But let's just, for those who don't know, this is a place where IRS data, so your income, has to come together, data from the Department of Homeland Security on your immigration status comes together, the Department of Justice on your criminal history. Incarcerated people, for instance, are can't get a subsidy. HHS and Social Security for enrollment in other entitlement programs. And fifth is data from the state government on your residency. So this is five streams of data have to come into place into a federal hub, and the federal hub needs to be able to interface with the state exchanges to determine whether or not you are eligible for the subsidy. So this is a fairly complex issue, and all of a sudden, we are now hearing, particularly over the weekend, we are hearing, oh my God, this is a terrible, terrible danger to Americans' privacy because of the amount of information there. So maybe, Bruce, we could start with you and anyone else who wants to weigh in on how valid do you think that critique is, and where do you think the federal hub is in its implementation?
I guess the perspective I would offer is that is really slightly broader, which is that as this debate actually illustrates, there are a lot of unanswered questions, and the policies around how this information will be handled are only now kind of being finally formulated, and they have downstream impacts on the designs of these systems and the business processes and the workflow. So take, for example, will a consumer be able to view their full federal tax information or Title II income as part of the information that comes back from the Data Services Hub? Our understanding is no, that's not the case. And so for states that may have designed a business process that began with presenting the consumer the information, most current information available from that source, and allowing that information to drive then their choice as to how they apply for eligibility, there's some reworking that needs to occur, and you have to turn to Plan B or Plan C to redesign that business process. Probably has an impact on the website, the workflow, and the system of record. Similarly, while I absolutely applaud the shortening of the application, the simplified application down to three pages with a fourth page, I think, which is an appendix which gets filled out if you have someone else completing it on your behalf, that change in systems terms really came at the 11th hour and has implications for the systems that are being
built. All the way back.
Yeah, and so that's really, it's those operational impacts, those technology impacts that the lack of clarity on these rules present that keeps the integrator and the vendor community such as ours up at night.
But will this be, as some are alleging, will this be a real, you know, potential for violation of American privacy? Will this hub, you know, be subject to all sorts of funny business? Can we build it securely enough?
The answer has got to be a straightforward yes, we can. The government has in its possession large volumes of data about individuals. The problem that has come up with the IRS is not one of violation of individual secrecy or privacy. That isn't the issue that's involved here. It's the alleged misjudgments by a number of middle-level IRS officials in administering a law. The idea that because the IRS may have, probably has, improperly handled one particular piece of legislation doesn't mean that it stands as a potential malefactor in the administration of health care policy. The IRS cuts all of our checks for Social Security. It doesn't set Social Security policy. It's an administrative agency that is involved in the implementation of a particular piece of legislation. As always, attention has to be paid to safeguards and avoiding serious mistakes, But this is no different, in my view, from a lot of other situations. I think Sheila really put her finger on the critical question. You have an all-out effort in Maryland, a unified government working on behalf of the legislation. In the state of Massachusetts, you had bipartisan cooperation in implementing something very like the federal legislation. As I mentioned, I'm on the district exchange, and I can assure you that this effort is proceeding in that same spirit. And I'm sure this is going to happen in a number of other states. But one could mention Michigan, Florida, Texas. It's maybe not so much in those places. So what I think is going to end up happening is that not so much October 1st, but January 1st, March 1st, as the legislation begins to bite, we're going to have success stories in some parts of the nation, and we're going to have a royal screw-up in other parts of the nation. And the question will be whether our political system is able to focus on the fact that this program can and will work in some places and use that, those success stories, as a template for where this process can evolve, and that's the hopeful story. Or, on the other hand, the disinformation system that has taken over certain elements of communication in the United States are able to emphasize the problems that will emerge, the messes that will occur, and turn this into a debacle. So I will end on one note of partisan agreement here. I think Mitch McConnell was absolutely right. I don't say that very often, but he was absolutely right that I think health care will be the major issue in the 2014 campaign.
Well, Josh, did you want
to? If I could, I often do agree with Henry, and I agree with him here as well. I think we will see a variation across the country in terms of the ease with which this is implemented. Going back to Henry's earlier comments about Medicare at the time of passage and subsequently the Medicare Part D benefit, one of the things that occurred there was you were dealing with a known population. These were people that were in the Medicare program or qualified on the basis of quarters worked. I mean, you had a relatively straightforward definition of who was eligible. I think one of the great complexities here for purposes both of the exchange and your description of the source of information into the exchange shows the complexity of we don't know who these people are. I mean, we know in a general sense who's uninsured. We know in a general sense who's exempt if you're a member of a tribal nation. But fundamentally, we really don't know who these people are, how they will come to us, and what the source of that information will be. We're also dealing with the enormous complexity of language. I mean, one of the points that was raised about the simplified form certainly helps. But if you're dealing in the state of California, I mean, you've got, 27 languages that you're dealing with, and that's true largely now across the country as well. And the ability of the individual to access the information, to confirm the information, whether they have pay stubs, I mean, all of the challenges that one faces in trying to reach out to a population that may have not had access to or information from or dealt with the government, I think will make, again, the success vary enormously across the country and make it quite difficult, again, in terms of how the information flows and how essentially we bring people into that system. I think it is a monumentally complicated process.
Josh, how do you think you're going to deal with this question of who's eligible that Sheila raised?
So just to make one point, we take security very seriously. All the states have security plans. There is a lot of attention being paid to that issue. And in the state of Maryland, we deal with all sorts of private information. We have infectious disease reporting and other things. And, we take that very seriously, too. I was at a meeting, I think, with some foundations that want to help us with our outreach recently, and one of the foundation representatives said to me that she was extremely worried. She was up all night. She was worried that people wouldn't spend the money, because of some of the issues we talked before around the mandate. It was just going to be too expensive, and nobody was going to sign up. Then the next person said that He was up all night. He was extremely worried. All these people were going to get coverage. We wouldn't have enough primary care doctors to take care of. And I said, you know, the good news for me is you both can't be right, you know, which I don't think either of them appreciated. You know, it's not a winning answer, but I thought it was pretty funny. You know? There are a lot of things as you think about this. It is obviously a complex undertaking. There are a lot of different, you know, directions that it could wind up going. And, you know, we have to be, you know, prepared to kind of roll with the punches a little bit. I think that there are risks in lots of different directions. And at the same time, there is a lot of potential benefit. And I think we're trying to keep our eye on that. And even where there are risks, I think, you know, we're trying to make decisions to mitigate them where we can. I'll give you an example. We made a decision, we changed our essential health benefit plan designation after we got additional guidance from the federal government because we realized we had some flexibility and we wound up picking our small group plan. After initially we jumped out and we picked a different plan, then we wound up with a small group plan because we thought that would be the most stable for the transition, and we had a little bit of extra ability to do that because of some rules that came out along the way. And we said, look, you know, we didn't get it right the first time, and we explained, you know, to certain people why something they were looking for wasn't going to be in there anymore, and we were able to get past that. There, you know, in terms of our high-risk pool in the state, we've made some decisions to keep the state part functioning for a while longer to help with easing the risk burden that's going into the exchange, in part because we want to be somewhat strategic about what happens in the individual market to the extent that we can be. So, you know, we're trying to make those decisions, but really we're going to have to see what happens. We're going to be keeping a very close eye on the enrollment. I think if our system, you know, works as we're hoping, we're really doing integrated Medicaid and exchange enrollment, we'll be able to answer some questions pretty well because it'll all be in one system, and that we can use to make adjustments as we go.
Well, that actually brings me to a question that I wanted to ask the panel, which is, you know, already HHS has had to delay implementation of on a couple levels. Implementation of the shop exchanges for small business has been delayed by a year. The pre-existing insurance plans stopped taking applicants in February because they ran out of money. They've been criticized over the last 2 years for giving out waivers to states and to companies for certain provisions of the bill. What's next? Okay, is it possible, for instance, that HHS would pull back on other requirements? The one that comes to mind you just mentioned, Josh, is that healthcare plans be certified as qualified healthcare plans. Is it possible that they pull back on that for a year or two if in some of these states not enough plans are signing up to be parts of the exchange? Or are there other things out there that could be, that there could be a pullback at least even temporarily in order to kind of get this rolling and without too much confusion?
I think most of that has probably happened. I don't think they're going to be major changes.
You think it's already, we've already.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, the federal government's not launching SHOP. My understanding is that they're just not launching the employee choice part of SHOP for a year. So there will be a small group market. But I think that we made some strategic decisions like that in Maryland. There are some things, you know, I've learned the lingo that, you know, the must-haves, nice-to-haves, you hear that a lot. If I had a dollar any time someone said, that's just a nice-to-have. You know, I'd be able to fund it all. The other phrase that comes up a lot is contingency. Mm-hmm. You know, the contingencies of this. I never really used that word in quite this way before we got in this discussion. Like, if this doesn't work, what's our contingency? So have we mapped out all the contingencies? Or dependency is another word that's related to that. So, you know, you have to, but I wouldn't anticipate, you know, major changes from here to October 1st. I could be surprised, but we'll see.
Do you agree, Bruce, then Sheila?
Bruce, go ahead.
Oh, just a quick note. I would agree completely that I wouldn't expect major changes. If anything, I think what we're seeing is a great deal of pragmatic thought as to what the implementation challenges are going to be in October and how through administrative relief and within the confines of their capabilities as an agency, they can offer some relief to states. An example being as recently as Friday, when a letter was sent to state health officials and Medicaid directors outlining five specific techniques that CMS is encouraging states to take to, they call them targeted enrollment strategies, to help facilitate Medicaid and CHIP enrollment and renewal in 2014. Mm-hmm. And one of those techniques is to allow states to implement the use of modified adjusted gross income sooner in October when those systems are ideally ready, and avoid that bridge period from October to January when eligibility needs to be determined in two systems. That mm-hmm. itself just introduces complexity, additional work, and so forth. Some of the other techniques are quite interesting, like, for example, using income evidence from SNAP eligibility determination as presumptive eligibility for Medicaid, and literally mailing Medicaid cards to individuals that they then activate when they call the call center to become enrolled. So I think, if anything, CMS is giving great thought to the process complexity, where the emphasis needs to go, as I said previously, on the consumer experience, and trying to facilitate as broadly as possible the uptake for those programs.
I wouldn't disagree that I don't expect any major changes. I think in some issues the question's been asked, and the department has essentially said we don't have the authority on certain delays. But I think some of the interesting conversations may occur around Medicaid. And the number of states, Arkansas being a good example, that essentially wanted to approach their expansion in a different way. The question of whether you can phase in, which was, the answer was no, but the question is, are there other approaches? I think there are interesting conversations occurring around what would be described as a bridge plan, which is dealing with people who essentially go in and out of the Medicaid program, whose yeah. income is relatively insecure, and essentially at one point you're eligible and at one point you're not. At one point you're eligible for a subsidy and at one point you're not. And essentially how to manage those individuals and families that are essentially in those kinds of transition periods. And so I think that there's a lot of conversation going on. But I think at the end of the day, a lot of this is going to be a function of what we find out. How many insurers essentially choose to participate? What are the rates like? What essentially, I mean, Josh points out that they made a decision about their essential health benefits and the plan that they chose mm-hmm. essentially as their model. Each of the states has gone through a similar kind of process. I worked with the state of Tennessee as they looked at this question and looked at and held hearings around the state to understand what people's interests were in terms of coverage. And as Josh pointed out, there's a great desire to essentially have as a required element certain benefits, which in other cases people would not view as essential. So I think we have yet to learn from some of those conversations, and that may essentially modify decisions going forward.
Yeah.
I think there's a simple answer that summarizes what people have been saying. All of the key deadlines are going to be met. The exchanges are going to open on October 1st. Enrollment is going to start then, and the plans will begin to, people will begin to go in on January 1. The other key elements of the proposal of the plan are going to be met. The administration has shown really very great flexibility in being willing to give ground on particular aspects of the bill that were potentially problematic. And I think the reason is quite simple. The first goal is to get this thing up and running. If it works, and I very much hope and expect that it will, then it's going to be with us for a very long time. And eventually, it may even become possible for constructive legislation to pass Congress to fix things that aren't exactly right just now. So the thing is to stay alive, get the thing up and running, and then try to deal with the problems that emerge in the way that Sheila described as we implement.
The one additional comment I would make is we still have legislatures who are meeting.
Yes.
And there are a number of decisions yet to be made by states. And I think that's also the unknown.
And by insurance commissioners.
And by insurance commissioners as well. So I think there is yet a series of decisions that are taking place at the state level in terms of what their decisions will be in terms of participation or not, exchange structure, governance structure, that really will yet inform us as to how this is going to go forward, to Henry's point.
Okay, so I want to take some questions from the audience now, but first of all, I'd like a quick answer from everybody on our continuum of hiccups to shambolic messiness to outright repeal. Where do you fall? Sheila?
Oh, my. I would fall somewhere between hiccups and seizures. I mean, somewhere somewhere at that end.
Josh, don't answer for Maryland. Answer for the country at large.
I think there's going to be a lot of variability. I really do.
Okay.
I think that's going to be, it's going to look very different in different parts of the country. And I do think that that'll, you know, probably be an important story.
Bruce?
I would agree. I think there'll be variability, perhaps call it auditable hiccups.
Okay.
That will decrease over time. It's certainly enough to raise eyebrows at a dinner party.
All right.
Extended indigestion.
Extended. Okay. Let's see. We have somebody with microphone. Please, because we are on C-SPAN, we cannot talk unless we have a microphone in front of us. So don't start talking until there's a microphone. And I think this woman right here. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Dr. Caroline Poplin. I'm a primary care physician. My late husband was Martin Slate, who was head of the PBGC in the Clinton administration. My question is about risk adjustment, something nobody has mentioned. Except Dr. Sharfstein briefly. The way the small group and the individual insurance, health insurance market has worked is by risk selection. Mm-hmm. And risky people, sick people essentially were excluded. And as going forward, unless this is controlled, it's possible that the company with the best plan will end up with all the sick people. And that could terminate that plan very quickly. And I wondered if any preparations were being made to do the risk adjustment, because it's very easy when you have different plans to select for the healthy people by something as simple as a free gym membership.
Anybody like to take that?
Well, there are several mechanisms the law sets up to mitigate risk. And, you know, there are a couple of them that the federal government is overseeing. There's one where the states have some options, and we're going to be running that part of the program. We also have some flexibility in state law to, in the out years, invest some state money in to do a better job of risk mitigation. So I think that it's going to be an important issue. Whether or not there's, like, you know, outright gaming of the system, I think that it's, you know, the selection is obviously a huge part of cost. The fact that insurers have to pay each other under some of the rules that are getting set up, you know, lowers that. Hopefully, we want to get to a point where it lowers it below the point where insurers can actually compete by doing a good job in, you know, helping to manage cost and joining with the delivery system in accomplishing better outcomes at lower costs. So to me, it's like, you know, you want to lower the reward to risk selection below where you actually get a reward for doing the right thing, and hopefully there'll be, you know, plans. And I think we have some very good plans in Maryland that are really thinking about the delivery system and keeping a relatively, you know, stable starting place for the different plans, I think puts us so much better off in the future than where we are now for that kind of, you know, gaming to happen. So, I can't say nothing will happen, but I think there are a lot of things that will make me think that it'll probably be less of an incentive to do that in the future.
Bruce, you wanted to say something?
I would just add that I think that in a way we need to go back to the future here a little bit and look at the initial implementation of Medicaid managed care and mm-hmm. going back to the Balanced Budget Act of 1997. And some of the processes that followed from that, that act actually created the role of an independent enrollment broker in the process of health plan selection for good reason, mm-hmm. because that was needed given those what went on in the early days. And as a consequence, when you really look at how exchange operations are set up, we think it's very critical that the information that's presented to consumers be done in a fair and unbiased manner. Certainly, a study that was published in Health Affairs in January of this year pointed out that participants in the Commonwealth Choice Program in Massachusetts, mm-hmm. which most closely parallels what we'd expect in the exchange with the precious metal levels of plan offerings, 40% of those individuals found the information on plans that was being presented difficult to understand. And when you look actually across industries, and Forrester Research did a study that was published in 2011, if you array, say, from left to right, the travel industry to the banking industry, ultimately to the commercial insurance industry, the percentage of individuals that need some form of assistance in making a plan selection in the commercial insurance industry is much greater. So while, again, it's an ideal to think about the Travelocity or Expedia experience here, the reality is that consumers are going to need help. There's a large portion, perhaps 80 to 90% of the individuals who will be uninsured and will be applying will never have applied for insurance before. So that availability of impartial, unbiased, and objective information presented in a format that's not overly complicated, because decisions can be, certainly your ability to make a decision gets skewed with the presentation of too much information, it's a known fact, is I think also critical to ensuring a positive consumer experience and relates to this issue of adverse selection and managing risk.
Good. Let's see, right over here, the gentleman right over here, and then we've got two more. I'm looking at you.
Thanks. I'm Charlie Clark with Government Executive. A budget question. How successful have the efforts by Republicans in Congress to defund it been in terms of impact on the implementation?
It's a good question. In the press, there's certainly a lot of talk about the fact that the hub was not funded, and that Secretary Sebelius has been having to do that out of her discretionary funds. What else do we know about that?
Well, we know that there's been the debate. In fact, Senator Harkin, who was quite concerned about the movement of money out of the prevention fund to certain activities to essentially find the resources necessary. The estimates for what was required by Treasury, by HHS, and the other agencies, but those two in particular, was quite substantial. And I think there's no question that it's had an impact on their ability, and potentially going forward, the ability of Treasury, for example, to fully participate in the required information sharing. It could well have an impact.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else?
I'd just say not as much in Maryland because of the way that the law was written for state-based exchanges and the way the funding goes.
Right. Yeah, I think this is we'll really see this in the federal ones. Mm-hmm. Either any?
I think that's right.
No, it's just, I don't think we know the exact numbers. We do know that there was money in the original legislation, and I think we know it was insufficient to take care of all of the costs associated with implementation. More money is needed, and it seems to me a peculiar strategy of governance to try to make legislation fail by appropriating so little money it can't be properly administered. It seems to me that's a kind of a Luddite approach to politics that is deplorable.
And it's one of the things that I thought was most instructive about your opening comments, that Medicare was done with the administrators in the room.
That's correct.
You know, and that this was done in really a very dramatically different way, and so we can expect.
But I think it also highlights the remarkable challenge here, again, because of the state-federal partnership that's expected. Mm-hmm. In the case of Medicare, you were really dependent upon a federal infrastructure. And in this case, you were really dependent upon both. And, of course, the navigators are to be self-funding, I think, 2015. They are to be fully funded by their own operations. So the expectation was that it wasn't going to be federal funds over the long term. And, again, this whole question about the federal-state responsibility and how that plays out by state, I think, is going to have a tremendous impact.
And the state exchanges are supposed to be self-funding as well,
so
that they're not a burden in the
right.
long run at all to the federal right. government. It's the federal agencies that are at risk here.
And you also have this problem of every, as I understand it, the state insurance commissioners, they all have different levels of power.
Absolutely.
So in some states, the state commissioner can turn down requests for premium increases. In other states, they don't have it much. In your state, yes.
Right.
But in other states, they can't do that. So that's why we hear a wide variety of speculation on what is this going to do to premiums, is because in some states, they might actually really go as high as 25 or 30%. In other states, they won't increase, or the increase will be very de minimis.
I think the main story on premiums is not the level. It's the diversity of impact across different classes of insurance purchasers.
Yeah.
There are going to be some people who will see big reductions. There will be some people who will see big increases. And the average effect, I don't think, captures the amount of turmoil and churning that's going to occur.
That's well put.
You know,
yeah, Josh.
One thing to mention is we've seen increases in the number of insurers who are interested in participating in Maryland, in part through implementation, and different mm-hmm. companies are coming into the state or springing up or getting interested in Medicaid, because now it's really created a very interesting dynamic, and even to the point when, you know, in the lead up to when the rates, the proposed rates, because there's a review going on, were coming out, there was a lot of like discussion of what one group is doing versus another group. And, you know, I mean, I think that if part of the theory here was that having a level playing field for the companies would induce some kind of competition around price, I think that, you know, I think we can see that happening, mm-hmm. not just in Maryland, but in other places where I've heard that people are already starting to revise their rates when they're seeing what other people are putting up there.
But I think you're also going to see plans who are going to wait and see what happens rather than play it first. And
yeah.
I think we don't yet know state by state how many insurers will in fact participate. And I think that will be a question of what they're looking at in terms of the market.
Right. And this is why it's possible for there to be such divergent predictions about this. Let's see. The gentleman in the blue there, you had a question right up here. Here's your microphone.
Hi, my name is Min from the NCPA. I have a quick question that we kind of touched on. This is the topic of young invincibles. Now, you know, you mentioned that they have...
You look like one.
Yeah, thank you. They have a perverse incentive to kind of wait, and, you know, there's a lot of criticism. They wait until they get sick, and then they can jump on a plan. How well do you believe that the federal government can convince these individuals to enroll in the plan, since there have been predictions that their premiums will increase due to the age ratings of the ACA?
I don't think we have a clue. There was an accommodation made in the legislation that allows for those under the age of 30 to purchase a catastrophic plan that potentially would be less costly. But again, I think it's going to be the calculation that any individual makes as to the cost of the penalty and the risk, and essentially the cost of the coverage. The age bands will in fact increase costs to younger people because essentially there's a compression. But again, I think it's going to be a state-by-state basis in terms of what's available on the exchange for individuals and small group, and whether or not the young invincible finds that that's a better use of their money or whether they'd rather wait and see if they got sick.
Any other comments on this?
I think Massachusetts didn't do a bad job of that. I mean, I think that there's a track record of being able to get people to sign up, and I saw some of their marketing materials, which were, like, directly aimed at...
Massachusetts got the Red Sox.
They got the yeah. Red Sox.
But
they
could
I
ask
you
a question? People to sign up.
Josh, I'd like to ask you a question that your comment on Massachusetts raised. They did a good job in this dimension, but with respect to getting small employers to come into the exchange, they didn't do a good job. Could you say something about what you expect to happen in Maryland with respect to small
sure.
businesses?
Sure. And we've thought a lot about that. We made a very important decision early on to try to, and we actually got some advice from people who had worked on Massachusetts and saw that as something that, you know, maybe they would have done a little bit differently. So two answers to that. First, we realize that small employers, they have roots to getting insurance now, and those usually go through the broker community, and in Maryland we have these third party administrators, and I think it dawned on me the important, I don't come out of this world, so it was new to me a little bit, but it dawned on me when I met with a representative of a physicians group about health reform, and he said, before I talk about what the physicians want to know, what I heard from my broker was, you know, and can you address that problem? So I said, okay, that's helpful. And something like 90% of people, because they're buying health, 90% of companies, they're buying health insurance, they may be doing payroll, they may be doing retirement, they may be doing all these different things, and they're not interested in breaking out, or they may not, most of them are not interested in breaking out health insurance, going to a separate website, managing that totally separately. So what we decided to do was to do it in partner, to offer the third-party administrators in Maryland the opportunity to plug into our exchange and have their systems work. So people could continue to get coverage if it makes sense to them to go into the exchange. They could do it through the normal channels. And there's an awful lot on our website that walks through all the thinking we did around that, and there are different models we're making available to them, and there's been a lot of work on the small group technical component for us to accomplish it. So, you know, we'll see. Now, what is the value to a small group? In Maryland, we already have a guaranteed issue small group market. So they're really, you know, the tax credits are obviously one value, and the other potential value is the employee choice. That, you know, and a small employer may find it to be valuable to offer, look, if you come here, you'll get your choice of different insurers rather than just one. So, but how that plays out, you know, I don't know. We certainly project far lower enrollment initially. I think of the individual market as an October 1, you know, we want people who are covered now to stay covered and add to it, and it's a big challenge right up front. I sort of think maybe it's a sprint on that side, and it's more of a marathon for the small group market. And, you know, if we have a few businesses at the beginning and it just pokes along and gets bigger as the value gets more obvious, then, you know, I think that's fine.
Let's see, there was another, let's go right there. The gentleman right on the aisle there, right there.
Hi, I'm Fred Altman, and there's a lot of talk about the variability, and I was just wondering how it breaks down. Are there enough on the side that it's likely to work very well that there'll be less congressional resistance and be able to continue it as opposed to almost everything is failure and then it'd be easy to kill?
Well, I would add that a question that I was going to actually ask Henry, because he said recently, and this is apropos of your question, he said recently the 2012 election kept the Affordable Care Act alive. The 2016 election will determine whether it survives. So that might
well,
be.
Well, I may
be,
you know, in light of Senator McConnell's statement, with which I quoted earlier, I may have been 2 years late on that. But what I had in mind, of course, is that as long as President Obama is in office, this is going to remain the law of the land. But I think the question you raise is one to which I would give Sheila Burke's answer. We really don't know. We're looking forward, I think, with high certainty to enormous variability around the country. We can count on the fact that various reporters and bloggers will grasp the mistakes and hold them close to their hearts and spread them around assiduously. And what I hope and I really pray is that those who, like myself, and I suspect all of us up here on the platform, think that the Affordable Care Act is on balance a step forward that should be built on and improved, will work just as hard to talk about the success stories that are going to unfold and the advances that are made, the subsidies that are claimed, the people who are insured, the continuation of a slowdown, as I hope, in the rate of growth of healthcare costs, a reduction in insurance overhead from the kind of competition that Josh described. And I think if we do our job well enough, it'll be an extended and very rough voyage, but it's one that can get us where we want to go.
See, there was another question over here. We had somebody else had raised their hand. I don't want to. Yes, right here, up front. Oh, okay.
Thank you. I'm Jean Ning Nguyen with Voice of Vietnamese Americans. And I'm not talking on behalf of the Asian American Pacific Islanders, but since I'm one, I just want to bring it to focus that we don't have, no one has raised voice for that population. And it appears that that population has been increasing in the amount quickly. And many of us actually are self-employed, and many of us not in the habit of having health insurance until we're very sick. And many of us kind of rely on family support, the extended family, and many just stay home and die at home. So we may not be a burden to the whole system. But now that there's a mandate coming, and I feel that the cost of health care can be reduced significantly with prevention, education, treatment. So, and also in the exchange, education, the understanding of the public can also play a significant role. So is there anything that planned out to educate that population? And I also want to track in the Latino American friends, because we're all in the same, in a way, similar boat. So is there any plan for that? Thank you.
I'd be happy to jump in and explain how we've thought about this for Maryland. So there's this program which, depending on your thesaurus, is navigator, assister, counselor, all that. And we had the flexibility in Maryland to decide how to structure that. We could have done it with one company, one approach, the whole state. We have a very diverse state in Maryland. We could have come up with 1,000 different little grants of tiny amounts of money, you know. And we did this through public comment. We actually had a whole advisory committee come together. And what we wound up doing was dividing the state up into 6 areas. And we asked groups to come together under a lead agency, but multiple groups, including grassroots organizations that work specifically with different parts of the population, to come together and put in proposals. And we had competition in each of the areas. And we have 6 lead agencies and more than 50 individual groups that are all part of one of those organizations, including groups that really target and have a tremendous trust within those communities. Because part of it is you could say, well, I'll give you something in a language that you can read, but if you don't know who that person is who's talking to you, you may not relate at all. And so what we've got is a, you know, I think a really terrific set of partners around the state. And they're now in the process of getting trained. This will cover the Navigator and Assister programs. And our goal has been, rather than us specifying what it is, we've asked people to come together. In Montgomery County, which is very nearby, the Montgomery County Health Department is the lead organization, but they brought in their best partners that serve all sorts of different communities in the county. So we think that being successful is not a one-size-fits-all message. We have to reach into a very diverse array of groups.
And Bruce, you wanted to...
I would agree completely in that I think we can also look at some of the experience of other public health benefit programs like the Children's Health Insurance Program, which started out small but now has grown to cover 86% of those individuals that qualify. And I think one of the reasons for that success, to Dr. Sharfstein's point, is that states became very, very focused on the appropriate means of communicating that last mile, if you will, in a trusted manner to the populations they're trying to serve. And when you consider that nearly 50% of the 50 million odd Americans or so that will be uninsured have either basic or below basic health literacy, that's a critical, critical point. And so ensuring that there is a broad patchwork quilt of community-based organizations, faith-based organizations, and others that can be used to reach those individuals is critical. And it's incumbent on partners in that process, such as ourselves, to work as we have historically in New York City alone, for example. As we enroll individuals in Medicaid, we work through a network of 400 community-based organizations to make that connection. And it has to be a very thoughtful, engaging, and pragmatic process. It can't be something you think about in the 11th hour.
Yeah, last week we had a forum with more than 130 faith leaders all about the Affordable Care Act and how they can get involved.
Tom, last question here.
Thank you. Tom Mann, Brookings. The expansion of Medicaid was, of course, to be a huge part of ACA and moving toward universal coverage. The court put a bit of a crank into those plans. Could you give us your assessment of where that stands now with the states and what we can expect over a period of time? Will it become more attractive and be picked up by more states? What happens to individuals in states that reject the expansion?
Well, I think, as was the answer on a number of these questions, we don't know. It is, in fact, a state-by-state discussion. Some legislatures have made a decision. Some have not. There are some that are, as we speak, meeting and considering either a governor's request or a legislator who wants to essentially overcome what the governor has decided. What happens to those individuals will also depend in part on the state. One of the odd quirks of the legislation, and I'll look to Josh to correct me if I'm wrong, one of the odd quirks of the legislation is that there is an element of the population who would be eligible under the expansion who will not be eligible for subsidies, the very low income. Others will be eligible for subsidies and can go through the exchange, and if it's a federal exchange or a partnership exchange or a state-run exchange. But there is a small group of those individuals who will not qualify for subsidies. They will be exempt from the penalty because they will be very low income, but essentially will remain uninsured. And again, it will depend on the state what the size of that group looks like. But, you know, the history with Medicaid suggests, and the same with CHIP, that it came in over time. Whether that will be the case this time around or not is remains unclear. The federal funding, the short-term 100%, will expire. It is available during that period of time and then goes away but drops to 90. There will be states who will look at what the economic implications are for the state over the long term and whether or not they will be taking on a greater burden or not. Other changes were included in the Medicaid program that were part of the ACA in terms of primary care physician payments and a variety of other things, the reduction in DSH payments. So there's this tension as well in terms of the reduction in the safety net payments in states that, in fact, may not be expanding their covered population. So there's a lot of that complexity, which is still quite uncertain. And my guess is it'll play through the legislative sessions in those states.
But did you want to add anything to that? Anybody else?
I would say that obviously in Washington there's a lot of politics of the Affordable Care Act, and that's carried into a lot of state legislatures, I think. But over time there's a question of, you know, is this really benefiting people and are people really going to experience that and what are the politics of that? When I go around Maryland, I hear about people who need coverage. That's what I hear about mostly. And I think, you know, there are a lot of people who benefit an awful lot from Medicaid, and as it expands in some states and not others, I think there'll be some politics of that also. And so I think you've got sort of the maybe some of the posturing or the the narrow politics of Medicaid, and then you've got just the politics of actually delivering health care. And you know, I think certainly in Maryland it was the politics of delivering health care overwhelmed any other consideration, and the finances of the offer are pretty good. But I think that there is something to be said for actually having a good policy that I think over time could change the politics.
And to Josh's point, underscoring it, I think among those who are most active in those states that have to date not expanded are the provider groups. And, you know, it's the hospitals and physicians and others who are actively engaged in talking with their legislators. And trying to make the point that Josh is making, which is over the long term, the value of coverage essentially will accrue to the benefit of the state. So, again, I think it's going to be a state-by-state conversation.
But the arithmetic of this is pretty straightforward. Every taxpayer in Maryland or any other state is paying taxes to support the extension of Medicaid in all the states that have adopted it. They are, if they don't come into the system, turning down at first 100% payment and then 90% payment for coverage within their states. This is about as close to the world of Vito Corleone, making an offer you can't refuse as you can get. And my concluding comment will be that a senior official in the National Governors Association, when asked the very question you posed, as of 2018, how many states will not be in Medicaid, he said, if Governor Perry is still governor of Texas, one.
Well, on that note, I'm going to have to cut this off, and I want to thank Sheila Burke, Josh Sharfstein, Henry Aaron.